Ryan, you're hungry, if you want to. Okay, so that's the first thing. Second,
I don't know about you, but I feel that it's possible you're somewhat confused about what the homework assignment is that's due on Wednesday. And just for clarification, there are some problems in the dimension formula chapter, and so those are assigned for Wednesday. And there's exactly one problem from the linear algebra chapter. There would be more, but I couldn't think of any. And that's one of the things I need to add to the book, is a much better collection of problems for the linear algebra chapter. And I haven't done that yet, so there's very little there. But there's one problem, and I think it may not be so easy. I actually stuck it as a problem because I wasn't immediately able to see how to give a method for doing it in the notes. So I decided to relegate it to an exercise. So it might be kind of hard, but it's the only problem in that chapter, and I think it'll be a good exercise. Let's see. Next, part three here, if you look at the back of the notes, has the plan for the rest of the quarter, so with days and everything. And today we're going to start on higher weight modular symbols, which would be probably complicated and scary to you, except you've already seen modular symbols in week two. So everything you see will feel very familiar, and just like, you know, when you're in sixth grade, you saw fractions again or something, and it didn't seem as intimidating because you'd already seen it in fifth grade and fourth grade. So you'll have a similar feeling going into higher weight modular symbols today. But you can see the schedules are going to spend this week on higher weight modular symbols, basic definitions, HEC operators, and computing modular forms using them. Then next week I'll talk about the Atkin linear B theory and new forms. Then I'll talk about specifically how to compute and store systems of, well, new forms. And then I'll talk about special values of L functions. So this will be a connection with the Bergson-Sorensen and Dyer conjecture. Then I'll talk about how Cremona enumerates all elliptic curves of a given conductor. And then finally, I'll talk about the Sturm bound, which is a really useful bound on how many coefficients you need to check in order to determine the congruence between two modular forms. Or if you want to generate the Hecke algebra, acting on a space of customs, how many Hecke operators do you need? There's an explicit bound. It makes it all very computable.
Crucial things to know to do computation. And before I start, on higher weight modular forms, I'm going to show you just a couple of examples of linear algebra in SAGE to illustrate some of the things I talked about last week. And let's see. So I'm turning verbose mode on, and what this means is that when I type a command, a whole bunch of stuff is going to scroll by telling you what it does and how long it takes in some cases. So we're just going to do some simple examples of some linear algebra. And this will just illustrate some of the algorithms from last time. So here's an example. I just made a random 10 by 10 matrix, and now I'm going to compute its reduced row echelon form. And this is a matrix over the rationals. So I type that. Shouldn't take very long, but again, never fear, a lot's going to scroll by. Okay, maybe not so much in this case, sorry. So it used the algorithm, the multi-modular algorithm for echelon forms, and used a height guess of 4096, meaning it thinks that the entries of the echelon form are most that big, and apparently that was big enough because the correct echelon form is given there. So we can try another better matrix, let's say 10 by 20, okay? So what does the echelon form of a 10 by 20 matrix look like? Well, it's going to, if it's a random matrix as this is, odds are it's going to have the identity matrix followed by some really big stuff, right? That's usually what happens. So let's watch it do it. So it's going to compute the echelon form, and what it did, I'll sort of lead you through what happened. Well,
what it did was it guessed based on some heuristic that I wrote and remember what it is, but it guessed that the biggest size of any entry in the echelon form would be that number. And then it, based on that guess, it used two primes to, it did echelon form mod two primes, essentially instantaneously. And then it used rational reconstruction, modulo the product of the primes, and unfortunately, it wasn't possible to even do rational reconstruction. Rational reconstruction fails, so you need more primes. So it just threw in a bunch more primes, essentially instantly did the echelon forms mod these, did rational reconstruction, and then recovered the echelon form.
Which I'll print out in a second. Warning is going to be huge. But there it is. At the beginning, let me view it in LaTeX. Notice that you have the identity matrix and then a bunch of rational numbers that are pretty big in the echelon form.
Notice there's some structure here, though. The denominators are very similar. And in fact, you can use that to speed up the rational reconstruction step
a lot. And I haven't implemented that, but it would greatly improve things if it were implemented. Okay, so that's a little teeny example. Let's try a better example. Another one is, say, a 50 by 50 matrix. Again, a random matrix that's 50 by 50. And I can pop it up, and maybe it's too small to see. Well, anyways, it's a matrix. You know what it looks like. 50 by 50 random elements. So time E equals A dot echelon form. Now, there's a parameter height guess that you can give, a guess on the size of the entries. So because this is a square matrix, probably the entries are all going to be like at most one. It's probably going to have echelon form the identity matrix. So I'll use that height guess. And by using that height guess, it was able to very quickly determine the answer. If I used a bigger one, it might do too much work. Actually, what happens here is,
I think at this point it notices it gets the identity matrix mod dot one prime, and then you know for a fact the echelon form is the identity matrix.
So you're instantaneously done. To make things a little harder, let's instead take a 50 by 51 matrix. So then what the echelon form is going to be the identity followed by some really nasty looking column. So now we can do the same thing, but with a height guess of 2, and it's very unlikely that will be correct. So what will happen is it will work modulo 1 prime, realize it doesn't work, and then throw in some more. And that's what happened. It actually did that more than once. So
it tried with 1 prime because I used a bad height guess. It didn't work, then it threw in a bunch more primes. That didn't work either, then it threw in a few more primes and that worked.
And I got the answer. And again, this is going to be a big matrix, but notice it has, it's basically identity matrix, and then there's that last column with big entries. So if I say A dot transpose 0, that will give the first, I want the last inch, the last row. Oh, 50. Yeah, no? Okay, I don't know. Oh, E, thank you. That transpose. Yes, so that's the last. You can see the last row is pretty bad. Has big entries. Tech gets completely disturbed. So that illustrates this little. We could try a bigger example, like, let's see, maybe 200 by 200. Again, here it will almost immediately find the echelon form, because again, it doesn't mod one prime and then it's done. There's also a sparse matrices. So if you say matrix space and you say sparse equals true, then it makes a sparse matrix, and it's a dense, it's in a space, it's represented in a sparse way, but because, let's see. So I say this, then it makes this space of sparse 50 by 50 matrices. Sparse here simply refers to the fact that a matrix is stored by giving a list of non-zero positions. It could still have all its entries non-zero. That would just be a very inefficient way to store it. But then you can make a random element, and I want to make one that actually is sparse, so I can give a probability of an entry being non-zero, say 0.1. That'll have 10% of the entries in each row non-zero, so they're mostly zero, and then you can ask for the echelon form. And it does all the operations using sparse arithmetic. So it does a height guess, and then it does it mod a couple of primes, and takes 0.01 seconds. Let's try another example. This will be the last example. Let's make a, say, 500 rows and, let's see, 300 columns, so that's pretty big, and then make a random element and make the probability of a non-zero entry be, say, 0.01. That's pretty small. And now let's compute the echelon form. So it did that one in 0.03 seconds. So it's a 500 by 300 matrix, but it's sparse, so it's pretty easy to do. Finally, maybe I'll be another example. If you compute a space of modular symbols, if I just do this, it'll do some sparse linear algebra, compute the quotient by the two-term and three-term relations, and that's what's happening here. It constructs a sparse matrix, and then it does the appropriate linear algebra, and it gets that the quotient has dimension 65. So let's do a harder example, 2006, see how long that takes. So it's almost instantaneous, I guess. No, well, not almost, but 1.82 seconds. So it sets up a pretty big matrix. Sorry, let me just carefully figure out where it started. It's hard to see because it's... sets up a matrix, and then it does echelon form. It guesses that the height of the answer is going to be very small. Just, I noticed that this is the case for these. And puts a certain matrix in reduced row echelon form modulo a prime in 0.17 seconds using sparse operations. Then it does the rational reconstruction. It works. The height guess is good. And then it sort of gets some information out. So just constructing the space works pretty well. There's one, 10,007. So it's doing some initial setup, which could be made faster by putting it in a compiled language. And then it does the actual arithmetic pretty quickly. So I guess the actual calculation for the echelon form is 1.13 seconds. And then there's some additional overhead for actually constructing some matrices from the answer, which could be set up a lot, which is 4.24 seconds. So this uses almost no memory at all. And this is a space of huge dimension. The hard part is if we compute a specific Heck operator on one of these spaces, then that matrix might be pretty dense. And then decomposing, finding its rational eigenspaces, or basically the direct sums of the eigenspaces, the kernels of F of, if the matrix is A, finding the kernel of F of A as F runs through the irreducible factors of the min-poly, that's what takes a lot of time. Okay, so now I'll stop. So any questions or anything about what I just did? So I just showed you some examples of multi-modular echelon forms. Unfortunately, I haven't implemented the matrix multiply echelon form, which would definitely be better in the dense case. And I'll do that. Okay. Okay, on to modular symbols, unless there are any questions or comments. Any updates or questions about your projects?
Okay, so you're doing ECM, you're doing linear algebra, Riemann normal form. What are you doing? You're doing a combinatorics partition function. How's that going?
Good. I got to mention books to help me figure out what I'm doing, summarize them, and kind of do them.
Excellent. What are you doing? I'll come back. What?
He's trying to find some formulas.
Formulas? Okay.
Yeah,
I don't remember either. And are you doing anything? Excellent.
Alright. So, now on to higher weight modular systems.
I'm going to explain essentially the references we're going to talk about today and or the rest of the week are the following. One is an article in Springer Lecture Notes in 1585 by Louis Moreau. And another reference is my PhD thesis. So I have a PhD thesis. I think that's it. I don't think there's anywhere else in the literature where higher weight modular symbols are discussed much. Maybe Gavardice's thesis, which just came out. There isn't much in the literature. So, so what I'll tell you about is higher wave modular symbols. So modular symbols have been around for a long time. Higher wave modular symbols have been around a little bit less time. This Springer Lecture Notes 1585 volume is something that was edited by Fry, Gerhard Fry, and it was about the Artin conjecture, which is a conjecture that says that if you have any any representation of the Galois group of QR over Q, let's assume it's not, doesn't have, let's say it's irreducible and n is greater than 1, since when n equals 1, you know exactly what's going on. When it's n irreducible and n is greater than or equal to, or sorry, strictly greater than 1, then the conjecture of Arden is that this has holomorphic L series. So if L row S is holomorphic on C, as an analytic continuation to all C. And I think that Arden proved in a paper long ago, I think in the 20s or 30s, that there's a meromorphic continuation, but there could be lots of poles a priori. And the amazing conjecture is that there's a holomorphic continuation. And there's a special case when the image is solvable. There's some work of Langlands and others that gives you this conjecture. They show that I think you need odd and solvable image, and then you can get. I'm not sure if you need odd actually, but it's known, definitely known if image of rho, actually the projective image of rho, so that means in PGL2, C is solvable, a finite solvable group. By the way, by definition, well, this is supposed to be a continuous homomorphism, and the topology on here is the discrete topology. This is the right topology on the Galois, and there's a topology on the Galois group, such that continuous means or implies finite image, though not conversely. So this has finite image, and if you projectivize the image, if that's solvable, then this conjecture is there. I think you also need that row of complex conjugation has determinant minus 1. So that's a case that's known, but solvable is pretty special. And very, very, very often these are not solvable. And this guy, Joe Buehler, proved it for one specific example in which the image is not solvable. He did an entire PhD thesis, which was one example, with the image of rho, the projective image isomorphic to the icosahedral group A5. Which is not a solvable group. And he had to work extremely hard to do all kinds of calculations of modular forms, et cetera. And this was his PhD under John Tate. So one example like that. This book, Springer Lectionnotes of 1585, is about giving, I think, a couple more examples. I forget how many, maybe 7 more examples. Using similar techniques to it. What's done here. So, 2 more examples. In Springer Lectionnotes in Math, 1585. And in that book, they systematically develop some foundations that you need in order to do calculations explicitly with these spaces, SK and epsilon modular forms. Because in order to verify this conjecture, one way to do it is to start with an example representation with icosahedral image, A5, which I say icosahedral because it's the symmetry group of an icosahedron. So you start with a representation like that, and then you find a modular form whose L function, a modular form of weight 1 whose L function looks like it's the same as this. And then you work very, very, very hard, and you prove that, in fact, the L function is the same. And then you get to conclude that, it's a theorem, a very old theorem, that L functions of modular forms are holomorphic. So if this is the same as the L function of a modular form, then you get it's holomorphic. Arden didn't conjecture that L functions of these representations arise from modular forms, but that's what you actually notice. And as of now, no one's ever given an example of a holomorphic thing like this, where it, at least with the determinant minus 1, which it doesn't arise from a modular form. That's really the only strategy we have for showing. So we get a few more examples. I think 7 were this way. And then, so this is in Springer Lecture Notes, 1585. Oh, and by the way, this condition that the determinants minus one, this is what you call phi. The representation has that property, it's either plus one or minus one. Your C is complex conjugation, and you call it phi. In the case when the determinant is even, there's no chance at all that the representation will come from a modular form. So you have to look elsewhere, and in fact, there's conjecture to come from Maas forms. So just an aside, representations like this are called even, and they're supposed to possibly be related to Maas forms. Maas forms are like modular forms, but imagine if you made the same condition that you make in defining a modular form, but left off holomorphic and replaced it by real analytic. Then you slightly modify the condition to define a modular form, and you consider real analytic functions that are, I think, eigenfunctions for a Laplacian, and you get an issue of Maas forms. And these hopefully give rise to all the even representations. But if you consider just the odd ones, then supposedly, I don't know if, I guess it sort of falls from language general philosophy that those should come from modular forms. So there are a few examples with icosahedral range from here. And then this is where I come along. So Kevin Buzzard and I so Kevin wrote me an email from Cambridge, and he said, I think I have a really clever method that allows you to get a whole bunch more examples. All you have to do is do a bunch of explicit calculations with this space, and I think that you could implement or make up some algorithms based on what's in this book that will allow you to do these calculations. This was in 1997 or 8. And he said, we have to do this really quickly because Richard Taylor and I are going to produce some general theorem, which is going to give infinitely many examples of icosahedral representations that satisfy Artin's conjecture. And we have to, we have to write our paper doing this computation before that, because otherwise it'll be out of date. So I thought, well, I can keep Kevin busy with this, plus he won't be able to write, finish writing the paper with Richard Taylor. And Richard Taylor's his strategy to prove that there are infinitely many representations that satisfy this condition and have icosahedral image relied on work of Mark Dickinson, who was doing a PhD thesis, so that was going to take a certain amount of time, and did. But anyways, we had a reasonable amount of time, like a year or two, in which to do this. So it sounded like a good project, and I got involved, and it turned out to be really hard, harder than expected, because to get any new examples at all, the levels that we had to consider were really big, especially given what people had computed at that time. It required a lot of memory, and we had to use some subtle tricks in order to we had to use a whole bunch of tricks that we didn't think we would need in order to verify that that various things happened. But we were able to give a bunch more examples.
In what case? What were the weights that we needed?
Okay, so we were producing, we needed to show certain mod 5 representations from modular. And these weren't modified representations coming from elliptic curves, they were modified representations coming from icosahedral Galois extensions of Q. So we took explicit polynomials that define these things that we got out of Springer Lecture Notes 1585, which has, by the way, a huge table of icosahedral Galois representations. That is to say, polynomials of degree 5 whose Galois group is A5. These are hard to find, they enumerated a lot of them. So we looked and we found examples where hopefully the level and the character and so on that we have to consider isn't too big. And then we considered the corresponding representation and then reduced it modulo, we reduced it modulo 5, and then we were able to prove that the mod 5 representation was modular via explicit calculations in here. And then we were able to use a lifting result that Taylor and Buzzard improved in order to say that if the modified representation, the modified reduction of this icosahedral Galois representation is modular, then there's a phi-adic representation that's modular. And once that phi-adic representation turned to be modular, you could then conclude that the original representation is modular. But the really hard part is proving that the modified representation is modular at all. So you can pretty easily write down a form that looks like it gives rise to the representation you're after, but you have to work some to prove that it really does give rise to the same representation as this thing that comes from Rho. But there's a lot of details. But basically, you end up having to do a whole bunch of calculations in spaces like this, but you get to do everything mod 5. And the weight would be, in some cases it was 2, and in some cases it was 5, depending on which would be better. And I remember finally getting access to this machine with a lot of memory in John Cannon's office using Magma. I was able to finally run the calculations at one point. It was pretty exciting to verify what I needed to verify. But we really, really had to figure out some things to get it to work. And this is written up in a paper called A Mod 5 Approach to Modularity by Cross-Regional Gaussian Representations. It has some useful computational techniques in addition to theory. And then, of course, Kevin and Richard Taylor and Mark Dickinson and the other people did eventually prove they gave a general condition under which you could verify Artin's conjecture. And then they verified that there are infinitely many representations that satisfy that condition. They gave a family of representations of that cosecantial image that come from a modular frame. Interestingly, though, the intersection of their family, or what their results apply to, with this is empty. So they still didn't wipe out the examples that we found by their general technique. So that's a little story, and that's what got me into reading the Leif Morel's article and then trying to make it all algorithmic. And the result of that is what I'm explaining to you right now, or what I'm about to explain to you. And I should say that these modular symbols that I'll talk about are they're not just a computational tool. For example, Frederick Grigoroff just did a PhD thesis at Harvard under Richard Taylor, and part of it is a formula involving modular symbols that will that allows you to construct elements of Schaffner-Richter groups of elliptic curves. So more precisely, it's a formula, and it's just an expression involving modular symbols. If that expression is non-zero in an appropriate sense, then you get a non-zero element of a certain Schaffner-Richter group. So he doesn't know anything about calculation, and he just wrote this very abstract thesis that gives this formula. And then I can go and use a programming person, compute the formula, and find, oh, wow, this element of this Schaffner-Richter group is non-zero, or there exists non-zero elements of certain Schaffner-Richter groups. So modular symbols aren't something that are just for computation. You can use them to prove, you can use them to express certain formulas that wouldn't be able to express nicely otherwise. So now I'm going to tell you what higher weight modular symbols are. Here's the definition. And this should feel very familiar. It's just a generalization of what I've already gone through in here with weight 2 modular symbols. So if you'll think back, I defined a space M, which was the pre-Abelian group on symbols alpha beta, modulo 3-term relations, alpha beta. Modulo these homology relations plus beta gamma plus gamma alpha is zero, and you mod out by any torsion, and you get a free Abelian group of countable but not finite rank on these symbols. You view the symbols as relative homology classes in the other half plane relative to the cusps. So this is an example of. This is an example of two modular symbols. Okay? Then you take the free Abelian group on these, and so an example modular symbol would be, for example, would be alpha beta plus 3/7 infinity. And you know all about these now. So now I'm just going to generalize this idea to higher weight. And I'm going to write down, again, something that is completely explicit, completely computable, and for which there's a natural pairing between the object I write down and modular forms. And this pairing is non-degenerate if you restrict to cuspidal modular symbols and cusp forms. And hence you get something, it also clearly respects the action of Heck operators. So you get an object that is dual to modular forms. And and the fact that this thing is dual to modular forms and that you have a nice integration pairing between it and modular forms allows you to get your hands on all kinds of things. For example, explicitly writing down spaces of modular forms, you can understand special values of L functions really nicely, etc., etc. You can compute that the Hecke algebra is a finite ring as a Z-module. You know this. Okay, so that's just the review. Now here's how it works. So fix an integer k greater than or equal to 2. Just like before, there's no notion of modular symbols of weight 1 that works really nicely. Though there might be a notion by now. I'm not sure what the status of this is, but people have thought a lot about trying to give some weight 1 analog of modular symbols, maybe just modular prime t or something. And I think Gallagher Weiss's thesis has something about this. I remember the week where I was telling you I had a student thinking about this, so I'm not sure what the situation is now, but just fix an integer greater than or equal to 2. There's also a rigid analytic PI analog of modular symbols that I don't understand, due to Glenn Stevens. But I would like to understand at some point. Okay. So fix an integer greater than or equal to 2. And now it's really going to seem very familiar, I hope. So consider this. This just means the homogeneous polynomials of degree k minus 2 in x and y. And it's just a possibly more explicit thing to think about than sim k minus 2 of z cos z. So it's non-canonically the same thing as sim k minus 2, if you like that better. But just homogeneous polynomials of degree k minus 2. And then let m sub k be z k minus 2 xy tensor m. And this is homogeneous polynomials, tensor, symbols alpha, beta. So an element here is simply a formal sum pi of x comma y alpha I beta j beta I, so as I goes from say 1 to n, and each of the pi is supposed to be homogeneous of degree k minus 2. So notice that this just extends the idea for weight 2 to higher weight, and if k equals 2, then this is just z, and you haven't done anything new. M2 is just m. And k equals 1 doesn't make any sense because what's a homogeneous polynomial of degree minus 1? It doesn't make sense. Okay, so we're almost there. Remember last time when we talked about this, I defined modular symbols for a subgroup G to be the, you take M and then you quotient out by subgroup of all symbols of the form x minus gx for x and m and g and g, and modulo any torsion. Okay, so you got something that g acted on trivially. This was weight 2 modular symbols. Let's put a 2 here, since m2 is the same as m. So what we need is the generalization of this to higher weight. And in order to do that, all I have to do is give a left action of SL2Z on MK. So that's what I'll do now. To generalize, we need a left action of SL2Z. See, here we had a left action via linear fractional transformations on these two things. So here, if x was alpha beta, then gx is g alpha g beta, and that's via linear fractional transformations. But we need a left action of SL2Z on a homogeneous polynomial p xy tensor with alpha beta. And I'm just going to completely drop the tensor sign for the rest of my life. Just think of it as a homogeneous polynomial times alpha beta. Since all this tensor product thing is, it's just CRU jockey here. Where tensor number z is down. So if you just view all the elements as being like that. So we need an action, and I already have an action on here, the linear fractional transformations. So if I define a left action on the homogeneous polynomials, then it will be set. So here's the action. If you have an element g in SL2z, then g of pxy alpha beta, which is an act on both factors, on g, it'll be something, which I'll tell you in a minute. So gp and then g alpha g beta. Okay, and here's how the action on g works. It looks a little funny when you see it first. First, I'll show you the formula, which will look completely ridiculous, and then I'll tell you why it's not. This is p of dx minus by minus cx plus ay, and then I don't have room to write this here. Actually, I do. But at least, well. Okay, so that is, believe it or not, a left action of SL2Z on symbols. Let me explain why this is a sensible thing to do. So if you let z equal xy, and view p of xy as being p of z, then here's what that is. The thing I wrote there is actually g p of xy, or the action of g on p of xy, parentheses in, this is equal to p, z here. It's equal to p of g inverse of z. Okay, because after all, let's just say that g equals a, b, c, d, then because g is an element of SL2z, g inverse is minus whatever it is, I guess you switch, change the sign. That's the inverse of g. You don't have to worry about the determinant because the determinant is 1. So, wait a second. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So if you act here this on this column vector xy, you get exactly what I wrote over there. So, dx minus ey minus cx plus ay. So, this action that I just defined is. It's like function precomposition, except you invert first. Now, the thing with function precomposition, until in generality, is that it's a right action. But if you have a right action, you can just invert before acting, you get a left action. So that's why that over there is a left action. And you can see there's a big equation at the bottom of the page that just completely explicitly verifies that it's a left action. But that's what this really is. This formula is simply invert the matrix first, and then precompose, apply that linear. Apply that function that you get on homogeneous polynomials of degree k minus 2 to x and y. So, in other words, SL2z acts on here, and also on here via sending x to dx minus by and y to minus cx plus ay. You can also think of it like. Well, let us stop. So that defines a left action of SL2z on MK. And now the space of weight K modular symbols for a finite index subgroup G. So now fix G contained in SL2z and a finite index subgroup. Then MKG is equal to. It's exactly like before, mk modulo the subgroup joined by all symbols x minus gx, where now it's exactly like before, that x is in mk, and g is in our finite index subgroup g, and modulo any torsion. Okay, so that's the place of weight k modular symbols. And it's just a generalization of what you have for weight 2. And you can define it for any finite index subgroup. It doesn't even have to be a congruent subgroup. Okay, so that's the definition. And I'll leave the action up here, since it's important. There's no way I'm going to get through all the bits, unfortunately, for today, so take a little more time. Okay, so that's the action. That's the definition of weight k modular symbols. Let's see. So I just finished section 8.1. Oh, one other definition. MKGR for ring R, say, any ring R at all, is MKG, which is a Z module, tensored over Z ring R. And every ring is canonically a ring over Z, so that makes sense. So, for example, mod 5 modular symbols is just usual modular symbols tensored with F5. Which basically means. Okay, so the next thing, remember we had netting symbols last time? That was crucial. We're able to compute modular symbols because you can write down a finite list of symbols corresponding to the cosets of your group G in SL2Z, which is a finite index. We wrote down a finite list of symbols, and those generated. Everything could be written in terms of them. There's an analog of that, even in higher rate. And that's what the second section is about. So here's how it works. The netting symbol associated to a pair P, comma G. So before you associate a netting symbol to a specific element, or more generally, or equivalently, its right coset. But now you associate a netting symbol to a pair P, G, where P is a homogeneous polynomial of degree K minus 2. And G, again, is an SL2Z. And here's what it is. Again, this just generalizes what we had before. It's G of P, 0, infinity. Where here, this means the action of the element G in SL2Z on the weight k modular symbol P, tensor 0, infinity, which is given right here on the board. So before, where in the case of K2, this P is just a scalar, and then it was just the same thing as before. But now you throw in this G. So that makes things a little more interesting. So I won't write it out, but that's the analog. So now the theorem. First important theorem is that MKG is spanned by, and this is over Z, so you don't have to introduce denominators or anything. It's spanned by the netting symbols x to the I, y to the k minus 2 minus I, capital G little g, where I goes from 0 up through k minus 2. And this runs through the right cosets of capital G in an SL2Z. So it's a finite list because G is a finite index subgroup. And I'll show you the proof that they generate. It's actually not too difficult. Okay, let me pause. Is anybody troubled about anything? Okay. So I'm just saying that if you consider high weight modular symbols, which is a weight 2 modular simulations, it's like weight 2 modular relations, but with weight k here, then These homogeneous polynomials, comma, these right coset representatives together generate. And by the way, just a remark, if you replace g by anything else in the same right coset, that is, if you multiply it on the left by an element of capital G, then that's exactly the same as multiplying this symbol on the left by an element of capital G. But this is an element of MKG. So by definition, an element of the quotient by the relations GX minus X equals 0. So anything in here is fixed under left multiplication by capital G. So that's why you can also just write it like this. So here's the proof. So I have to show that any symbol like this is a z-linear combination of symbols of this special form. Okay. Now, first, p is a sum of homogeneous polynomials x to the I, y to the k minus 2, minus I with various coefficients. So it would suffice to prove this for symbols of this form. Because if I could show up for all of those, I could all sum some things like that. And then every homogeneous polynomial is a sum of binomials like this with some coefficients. Moreover, you have the relation that says that in this tensor product, you have the relation that this is equal to x to the I, y to the k minus 2 minus I, alpha 0, plus the same monomial, x to the I, y to the k minus 2 minus I, just linearity of the tensor product, 0 comma beta. So it suffices to show that everything in the form is homogeneous polynomial times 0 beta, is a sum of these special symbols. And to get that, you just, as before, you continue fractions to write 0 beta as a sum of g applied to a whole bunch of different g's applied to 0 infinity. So remember how before, we used continue fractions to find a whole bunch of g's that sum gi 0 infinity is equal to 0 beta. This was in weight 2. Now you do the same thing here, but you have some gi inverse p 0 beta, and 0 infinity that equals p 0 beta. And you just notice that if p has, well, you notice that gi inverse applied to p, you'll get some huge homogeneous polynomial that again has integer coefficients. So once you have this, you just take exactly the same formula, but you have to change the coefficients in this funny way. And that gives you, again, that you can write anything in terms of these symbols in more generality. It's just a little bit of work you have to do a little bit differently to deal with the coefficients. So, but I'm out of time to explain that. This is, in the notes, this proof is given. It's very easy to read in the notes as well, on page 118. It's right there in the displayed equation. So I encourage you to look at that. I'm going to start with theorem 822 on Wednesday. That is a proof that the Manning symbols satisfy certain relations, and then I'll discuss why those are all of the relations. Okay? So I'll see you all on Wednesday.